You're listening to The Naked Scientists with me, Ginny Smith, and with Dave Ansell. Next up, we're moving on to our main topic, nuclear fusion. All around the world, countries are trying to come up with new ways to power their cities, cars, and homes. Energy consumption is a growing problem as our demand for power increases to keep up with our busy lifestyles. At the moment, we're reliant on fossil fuels, but these are rapidly running out and polluting our environment. Another option may be nuclear fusion. But scientists have been promising us clean, unlimited energy for the past 60 years, and it hasn't yet materialised. So could it be the answer?
But before we tackle that, let's look at the basics. What actually is nuclear fusion? Many of us might have heard the term kicked around before, but do we know what it actually means? On the line now is Professor Brian Fulton from the Physics Department at York University. Hello, Brian.
Hello.
So what actually is nuclear fusion?
Nuclear fusion is the process where we take a couple of small nuclei in the sun where it happens. We have hydrogen nuclei and we push them together so that they join, hence the term fusion.
So the nuclei are the little tiny positive bits in the middle of an atom?
They are, yes. And in the sun, which is a big ball of hydrogen, the temperature is so hot that the electrons that normally orbit around the nucleus have been knocked off. So we have bare nuclei, bare protons, which is the nucleus of hydrogen.
So these are somehow joining together. How does that actually work?
In the sun, which is a large ball of gas, in a gas, the atoms rush around. The higher the temperature, the more they rush around. And they're continually colliding against each other. And if we heat the gas up sufficiently, then the nuclei will collide so violently that they will fuse together. It's not an easy task because each nucleus has a little positive charge on it. And as we remember from our school days, positive charges repel. So it takes a lot of effort to get the two little nuclei to come close together because we're pushing them against that electrostatic repulsion. But if we get the temperature high enough, they'll collide violently enough that they'll get close enough and they'll fuse together.
I guess it's quite a good thing that this isn't too easy because otherwise the sun would kind of burn out very quickly, I guess.
It would, yes. The sun's doing this all the time. That's where all our energy comes from. The sun is turning about every second, about 1 billion tons of hydrogen is transformed into helium through this process. And that's what's produced the energy which keeps us alive here on Earth.
That sounds like a lot. I guess the sun is very, very large.
The sun is pretty big. It's going to be around there for a few billion years more.
So how come the sun is going to sit there for 5 billion years stably? Is there anything which is stopping it either exploding or kind of fizzling out?
The sun is in a state of equilibrium at the moment. The nuclear energy at the center is heating it up and trying to push it out and expand it like any gas does when you heat it. But gravity, of course, is there as well. And since the sun is such a huge, enormous object, gravity is very strong. So we've got a bit of a balance at the moment for the next few billion years where the nuclear energy will be just enough to stop gravity compressing the sun. But in a few billion years, once the nuclear fuel in the center of the sun runs out, then that's it, I'm afraid.
So if it's just happening naturally all the time, why is it very difficult to do on Earth?
The problem here on Earth is that the temperature you require for this gas to be moving around, this hydrogen, is several million degrees. And it's very hard to contain that gas. You can't put it inside a container because we don't have anything that will survive temperatures of a few million degrees. So we have to find other clever ways of containing that gas. And magnetic confinement is currently the best option, but there are other methods being looked at as well.
So basically the problem is, if you let it expand, even if you had a big enough bottle, then the pressure would go down and the atom and the little nuclei would stop bashing into each other and stop sticking together and stop fusing.
Yes, it's a balance between having the density high enough so that there are many collisions and the temperature high enough so that the collisions are violent enough to overcome that or electrostatic repulsion. So technologically extremely challenging.
Thank you. That was Professor Brian Fulton from York University.
So if nuclear fusion is so difficult to do, why are we even trying? Well, Mitchell Wardrop is the features editor for Nature, and Hannah Tooley asked him if nuclear fusion is really going to be all that we've been promised.
Well, of course, the biggest positive for fusion power is that unlike coal or natural gas, It does not produce any greenhouse gases, no carbon dioxide. It's not burning anything, at least not in the conventional sense. So it's carbon-free and good for the climate. Coal, of course, is by far the dirtiest fuel in that sense. Natural gas is somewhat better, but still does produce quite a bit of carbon dioxide. And if you're running an industrial society, if you're running factories, if you're running cities, or if you, for that matter, if you run electric cars, you need reliable power 24/7, whereas wind and solar cannot give you that. They are valuable sources, but they can't provide what is called baseload power. Fusion can do that in principle.
Is it as safe as other, say, for example, wind power? We just need it to be a bit windy, or solar power, it's just got to be sunny. Is this a safe method?
Fusion power cannot blow up like an atomic bomb. It cannot melt down. It can't do any of the things that we worry about with nuclear fission power, which is a very different kind of process. Fusion power will produce a relatively small amount of radioactivity. A lot of the energy comes out in the form of neutrons, which makes the walls of the reactor radioactive. And that does create a waste disposal problem. But this nuclear waste, this radioactive waste, is not nearly as big a problem as the kinds of waste you get in nuclear fission, because the radioactivity decays relatively rapidly within a century or two, and would be completely safe to handle. Contrast that with the spent nuclear fuel, which will be dangerous for something like 20, 30,000 years. So in that sense, it is safe, comparatively. Be careful about what you compare it to. Coal, which of course is very, very common, is the most common fuel currently in use. The mining of coal is quite dangerous in terms of, you know, the health problems it creates in miners, in terms of the environmental problems it produces around the coal mines. And by the way, coal itself contains a certain amount of natural radioactivity. It's actually more radioactive than, you know, certain types of radioactivity produced in the nuclear fuel cycle.
So you mentioned earlier that renewables weren't as efficient as we need them to be, and fission's a bit too unsafe for us to go on. But fusion, we've not yet had a positive power output. So which one of these options is most viable, if any of them?
Nuclear fission has its problems, but there are advanced designs that are much safer than the ones we've been using for 30 and 40 years. There are designs that physically could not melt down. There are designs that could, in principle, burn up nuclear waste instead of making more of it. You know, there's a lot of research, but right now there are commercial nuclear reactors running right now. And that, for the most part, have operated safely. One of the problems that happened at the Fukushima reactor in Japan was that it was an old design. It was designed dating from the 1970s and didn't incorporate a lot of the safety features that the most modern designs now incorporate. So fission is quite viable. Wind and solar, of course, are quite viable. It's simply that you can't always rely on them to produce power in a steady fashion. Again, people are working on that. If you could store the power in gigantic batteries, you know, that would solve that problem. But the problem is that nobody knows how to do that yet.
So as demand for energy increases, do we actually need nuclear fusion?
I would say it's a long-term solution, because remember, as the developing world, China, India, Brazil, all these countries which are, you know, fast entering the modern world and, you know, improving their economies and creating a middle class, people who want to run their computers and their washing machines, so forth, they need huge amounts of power. Right now, China is meeting most of those needs by building lots and lots of coal-fired power plants and creating huge amounts of carbon dioxide, not to mention ordinary pollution. If everybody in the world were to aspire to a typical British or American middle-class lifestyle and they did it by burning coal, you know, we would have hideous pollution. We would greatly accelerate the emission of carbon dioxide and accelerate climate change, and we would be in real trouble.
Hannah Tooley speaking to Mitchell Waldrop, the features editor for Nature.
One group of scientists trying to create the elusive positive power output is a team at JET, the Joint European Torus. The machine is the largest facility of its kind in operation today. I went to visit JET at the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy in Oxfordshire to see what it's all about and talk to physicist Sarah Medley.
Fusion happens in the sun, and that means it's very difficult to do it here on Earth because the sun is a huge ball of burning gas and we're, you know, one little planet trying to do it here. So in fusion research, we're trying to recreate that process here on Earth. We're trying to fuse hydrogen together to produce helium and release lots of energy so that one day we can generate electricity from that fusion reaction. To do that here on Earth, you need to heat them to such a high temperature that they turn into something called a plasma, which is basically, you can think of it like a very hot gas where the electrons are separated from the nuclei.
So why do you need to get it so hot?
It needs to be so hot because of the fact that fusion is very difficult to do. If you go back to thinking about an atom has a nucleus in the centre and electrons on the outside. So electrons are negatively charged and nuclei are positively charged. So if you've got one nucleus and you bring it close to another nucleus, those are both positively charged particles. And so because they're both positively charged, you've heard of opposites attract, like things repel. Well, basically the two positive charges repel each other. So to get them close enough in order that they want to actually fuse together, you need to give them a lot of energy. So you need to heat up the whole plasma to actually get the nuclei close enough for fusion to happen.
So you've basically got to throw these particles together hard enough that they can't bounce off and they actually stick together.
That's exactly it. Yeah, you want them to not bounce off each other, not repel, but actually stick together and fuse and release energy.
So how do you go about basically confining a bit of the sun in a large metal box just behind us?
So when you separate the electrons from the nuclei, it means that this plasma, which consists of the electrons and nuclei, can actually be controlled by magnets because charged particles do react to magnets. You can actually control them and move them. So basically, we have the plasma inside the fusion reactor, the tokamak, and we use huge magnets to control it and keep it away from the metal walls.
So the charged particles essentially get trapped by a magnetic field and will follow that magnetic field. So what actually does the JET machine behind us look like inside?
So at the heart of JET is a donut-shaped chamber. JET actually stands for Joint European Torus, and torus is basically the scientific name for a donut. And inside the torus is where we put the plasma. So we start off just by puffing some gas inside the chamber. And then we pass a huge current through it, which turns it into a plasma. And then we apply lots of different heating methods to heat up the plasma to actually 150 million degrees C, which is 10 times hotter than the core of the sun.
That's really, really hot. Why do you actually need it to get hotter than the centre of the sun?
It's because of size. Basically, the sun is so big. If you've got sort of hot plasma inside the sun, the heat can stay contained in the sun. You think of it like if you've got, say, a bathtub of hot water and you've got a small cup of hot water, the bathtub will retain its heat for longer than the small cup of hot water. So if you think of the sun as being like the bathtub, the heat will stay inside longer, whereas here on Earth, the JET tokamak is like the small cup of water, so it loses its heat quickly, so it has to be hotter to begin with.
So how actually do you heat up the plasma to this incredibly high temperature?
So there's a few different methods we use. The first method is called ohmic heating. And what that means basically is we pass a current through the plasma in the same way you can pass a current through a copper wire. And everybody knows if you pass a current through a copper wire, it heats up. So the plasma does the same thing. So that's the first way we heat the plasma. But that's actually not enough by itself to get the plasma up to the 150 million degrees temperatures that we need. So we have a few extra methods. One of them is called radio frequency heating. And that's basically analogous to a microwave oven. The same way that your microwave oven excites water molecules to kind of heat up your food, radio frequency heating fires radio waves into the plasma to then heat up the plasma, excite the plasma particles. And the final heating method is called neutral beam heating. And that's analogous to a cappuccino maker. When you have a jet of steam that you shoot into a cup of milk to warm up the milk, we basically send a jet of neutral particles into the tokamak to heat up the plasma because the energy is transferred from those energetic fast particles to the particles in the plasma.
So when JET is actually fired up, what actually happens?
every time we run an experiment on jet, that's called a plasma pulse. And that's basically because we have sort of 60 seconds where we've got a plasma inside the machine and the machine's operating properly, and we kind of get all our data from the experiments that we do. And then we finish off the pulse and we do another one 20 minutes later. So we do that throughout the day. And then all the data from those experiments is what we use to kind of progress fusion research further.
So they're about to fire off jet and create a plasma at several hundred million degrees centigrade in the center of the tokamak next door. They're counting down. So there's a series of video screens in front of us. So you can just see light being created. I'm guessing that's from the plasma itself. It's getting very, very hot at the bottom, and I'm not sure if there's a nice plasma going on in there.
That looked like a nice plasma to me.
So this whole process is incredibly difficult and incredibly expensive. Why are we bothering?
It would produce so much energy, but also in a clean and reliable way, that it really would be the energy source of the future.
That was Sarah Medley from the Cullum Centre for Fusion Energy.
Now, not everyone is convinced that this magnetically confined, or tokamak, method is going to be the most effective way to create nuclear fusion. Another approach is called inertial confinement fusion and is driven by powerful lasers. Joining us now is Kate Lancaster, the Plasma and Fusion Industrial Officer for the York Plasma Institute. So, Kate, what exactly is inertial confinement fusion?
Essentially, what you're trying to do is confine the fuel with its own inertia, i.e. make the fuel move until it confines itself. And it's an inherently pulsed form of fusion, so you need to do it multiple times a second in order to get net energy out.
So when you say it's confining itself, can you explain to me what that means? Because I'm finding it quite difficult to picture.
Let me explain it in terms of laser fusion. What happens when we do laser inertial fusion is you fire several hundred of the world's most powerful lasers on a very tiny ball bearing sized pellet of deuterium and tritium. The outer layer actually heats up and expands very rapidly. And we all know Newton's third law, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So it's kind of like gas coming out the back of a balloon. The balloon has to fly forward. So if the outer layer is heating up really rapidly, the rest of the fuel has to compress and stagnate, and it just basically confines itself.
So you're kind of using its own expansion to squeeze it together?
That's exactly it, yes.
Now, you mentioned deuterium and tritium. We've been talking about hydrogen as the source of fuel. So can you tell me a bit about why you use them instead of normal hydrogen and what exactly they are?
Well, actually, magnetic confinement fusion also uses deuterium and tritium. They're basically types of hydrogen. So hydrogen is basically a proton with an electron going around it. Deuterium has a neutron in that nucleus too, and tritium has two neutrons in that nucleus. So that's essentially just two different isotopes of hydrogen.
And why are they better than using the standard isotope?
So the sun actually turns hydrogen into helium. It's one of the most energetically favourable ways of getting fusion because you don't have to work as hard as you would if you were using hydrogen, basically.
Does yours differ from the tokamak approach? You're using it to confine itself, but what else is different?
So the whole approach is different in that with a tokamak, what you're trying to do is confine a certain density for, you really want to do it indefinitely, whereas in laser-driven fusion, what you care about is getting it to a very high density in a certain radius, and that whole process only lasts a few tens of nanoseconds. And then the second thing that's different, obviously, is then you would need to do this multiple times a second in order to make that work. So it's sort of just a completely different approach.
Why are there so many different approaches to nuclear fusion? Can we not calculate which would be the best way of doing it?
There's myriad of ways in which you could do it, but it's about the ways in which are the most sort of energetically favourable, let's say, where you're going to get the most bang for your buck. And it would be great if we could calculate it, but the fact is we don't know all the physics yet. So I think that's the bottom line. Until we do know that, because it's still very much a science project, we're not at the stage where it's just engineering problems.